From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On March 6th, on Air Force One, President Obama was asked by a New York Times reporter whether he was a socialist.
Let's take a look at the budget. The answer would be no.
He went on to defend the fiscal responsibility of his budget. He didn't tackle the socialism question. The issue must have weighed on him, though, because soon after he landed, he called up the Times.
It was hard for me to believe you were entirely serious about that socialist question.
Mm-hmm.
I did think it might be useful to point out that it wasn't under me that we started buying a whole bunch of shares of banks. It wasn't on my watch.
The pot, according to Obama, is calling the kettle pink.
The socialist charge has been used in reference to Obama's tax policy, his handling of the banking crisis, his stimulus package, and his budget proposal. But it first gained attention on the campaign trail.
An Ohio plumber asked Senator Barack Obama why he wants to hike his taxes if he believes in the American dream. Did Senator Obama answer him and win him over? On the phone now is Joe Wurzelbacher. Joe, did he win you over?
No, not at all. He said he wants to distribute wealth. And, I mean, you know, I'm not trying to make statements here, but, I mean, that's kind of a socialist viewpoint.
The S word popped up again in recent weeks amid rumors of a program for nationalizing the nation's banks. Republican Senators Jim DeMint and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee invoked it. So did right-wing bloviator Glenn Beck.
Hey, has anybody noticed this crazy thing that we're on the road to socialism? I'm just saying. Wow.
Last month, Newsweek had a cover story titled, "We're All Socialists Now." And in two polls in January, Fox News found that 50% of Americans feel the country is drifting towards socialism. And 65% believe that's a bad thing. When words percolate up through the media, we like to put them through the OTM extruder for a segment we call Word Watch. Although this week the phrase meme watch is probably more accurate. There have been two predominant political memes of late, one from the left, one from the right. We'll look at both. First, from the right, Obama is a socialist. Andrew Koppelman, professor of law and political science at Northwestern University, says that when we hear socialist invoked, we should ask ourselves a couple of questions.
What does the label socialism stand for, and what are the presuppositions when you use socialism as an epithet? If you use the label to describe Obama, I think what you're saying is there are two alternatives. Either the government intervenes in the market or it leaves it alone.
So, in any way whatsoever, does the president have socialist tendencies?
Socialist generally means the belief that capitalism ought to be abolished and the state ought to run the means of production. If that's the definition, Obama is absolutely not a socialist.
But the president's program with its bank bailouts and its changing tax structure and his ideas for healthcare reform are to the left of whatever it was we had before, no?
That's absolutely right. But in the 19th century, the socialist movement split between people who wanted to abolish capitalism, either through undemocratic means, that was Lenin, who wanted a little revolutionary vanguard to take over, or democratic socialists who wanted to do it through the electoral process, and other people who, you saw this split particularly in the German Socialist Party around 1900, who accepted that capitalism wasn't going to go away, and thought that what you wanted the state to do was intervene to moderate the failures and excesses of the market. The interesting thing that's happened through the 20th century is that the Social Democrats have won. There are almost no states in the world now that want to leave the market absolutely alone.
The fullest expression of the 19th century Social Democrats, I suppose, is Northern Europe now. How much farther would President Obama have to go before we became Sweden?
Well, you'd have to raise tax rates to 50%. You'd have to have much more robust public sector than anything that Obama is contemplating. The government would provide a huge range of services that doesn't provide now.
In the 30s, when they called FDR a socialist, that meant, you know, creeping Leninism. That meant it was the avant-garde for Soviet Russia. does the epithet have the same clout that it did in the 30s and the 40s and maybe especially the 50s?
Well, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, there was a serious concern that Leninism was going to take over the world. It certainly had those ambitions. And starting in the 1950s, it had nuclear weapons. And so this was a big, scary force in the world. That's not the case anymore. I don't think that socialism is what primarily scares most Americans. Most Americans are scared about losing their jobs.
Andy, thank you so much.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.
Andrew Koppelman is a professor of political science and the John Paul Stevens Professor of Law at Northwestern University and contributor to the blog Balkanization.
We're joined by Ben Smith of Politico.com. The Obama is a socialist thing has become a meme, which is defined as a cultural item that is transmitted by repetition in a manner analogous to the biological transmission of genes. So we called you because of another meme that's been making the rounds, the one that goes, Rush Limbaugh is the head of the Republican Party. It's been everywhere, both on liberal and conservative media, not to mention twice on this program. Recently, Politico.com offered an anatomy of this meme. It's a great lesson in political strategy and media manipulation. Could you walk us through it?
Sure. Well, I mean, first I'd say that's maybe less a meme in the sense that it's sort of organically and transmitted than some kind of bio-warfare or something like that. I mean, it's really injected into the system. There had been polling last fall where Democratic pollsters outside the White House, outside the Obama campaign, noticed that Rush Limbaugh was not only just wildly unpopular with Democrats, but also with independents and with moderate Republicans. And in fact, his negative ratings were worse than those of Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who'd been like the main boogeyman of the entire presidential election cycle.
And Bill Ayers.
And Bill Ayers, and who I guess nobody had heard of, even despite the hammering.
So this was James Carville's polling company,
right.
And he and fellow Democratic pollster Stanley Greenberg tucked this information away and waited for what Paul Begala called a tripwire to let them use it to their advantage. What was that?
Right. It was just in January Limbaugh was talking about Obama and said he hoped Obama failed. And now, I mean, I think, you know, in good faith, you could say, well, you know, as a conservative, he's saying that he hopes Obama's agenda to turn the country into a socialist megastate is going to fail, rather than that he hopes America fails. But that's certainly not how it sounded.
And so in Politico.com, your colleague Jonathan Martin wrote that initially the idea was to use Limbaugh's remarks to get the Republicans to support the stimulus package. How is that supposed to work?
Well, and basically these two give them a choice between being the party of sabotage, you know, economic sabotage, and being the party of progress. And it was, so the idea was to trap them into, you're with us, you're with Limbaugh. That didn't work, though I think it did do something to tarnish the Republican brand.
So then the question of whether radio host Rush Limbaugh is leader of the Republican Party takes off. They're talking about it on the left, on the right, in the mainstream media. Rahm Emanuel goes on Face the Nation and brings up Rush unprompted.
He is the voice and the intellectual force and energy behind the Republican Party.
And White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs snarkily referred to the head of the RNC's apology to Rush.
I was a little surprised at the speed in which Mr. Steele, the head of the RNC, apologized to the head of the Republican Party.
Was this as coordinated as it seems?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was certainly being discussed kind of in the inner circle as a really effective club to use against Republicans. It was also, meanwhile, being discussed in these sort of new channels that the Democrats' allies are using to organize themselves. There's a 8:45 a.m. conference call every day between 20 or 30 kind of left-leaning groups. But you'll see groups like the League of Conservation Voters, an environmental group that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be talking about Rush Limbaugh, start attacking skeptics of global warming by branding them with Rush Limbaugh. And so there was this very kind of broad, coordinated assault across the party.
So that had been going on for a couple of weeks, and then your colleague Martin figures out the meme has been intentionally cooked up by the Democrats. He writes the article, and then what happens?
Well, then the Republicans finally sort of figure out what their pushback is going to be, which is to claim that the Democrats are using this to distract from the economy, that Obama's playing a kind of politics he promised not to.
It seems to be a bit meta for these times, don't you think?
Given that the attack itself is already pretty meta, the conservative pushback is way too abstract, I think.
Do you think it might help if prominent Republicans stopped apologizing to Rush?
Right. I mean, I think the reason it works is because it exposes the fact that the Republican Party, particularly the kind of reduced rump Republican Party in opposition, is dominated by conservative voices. And so it's a way to sort of push them into the arms of those voices and kind of hammer that connection. And those voices are not ultimately going to be appealing to the majority.
Ben, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ben Smith is a reporter for Politico. James Carville is the political strategist and pollster who, with Paul Begala, seems to have got the ball rolling on this thing. It started with that pre-election poll that had Limbaugh's popularity barely in double digits among people under 40, and then Limbaugh's remark about wanting Obama to fail. But when we caught Carville on the phone, he said the real eureka moment came after that.
Well, the moment was this delicious thing of him going to CPAC.
CPAC, yeah, the conservative conclave.
Bouncing up and down like a big bowl of Jell-O, of which the cameras couldn't get enough of. I mean, I'm delighted to be on radio and taking credit for this, but the real credit belongs to Rush. Here you have one of the most unpopular people in the world, who all the Republicans are groveling to, and I think we both said, hey, let's shed some light on this.
Did it accomplish, at least for a time, what you wanted it to?
Well, it's still accomplishing a lot. Every day he talks about this. And he talks about how many people listen to his radio show. I wish everybody would listen to his radio show. I think people need to hear what he's saying.
One last thing. Back in the 90s, when you were in the Clinton war room, news cycles were a lot slower. Has the ability to control messages or insert ideas into the media ether changed?
Oh, yeah. You have the internet thing. You're out there. You got, a lot of cable channels, you got all of that, and stuff happens kind of instantly. But there's nothing that drives a story better than a personality, and that's what Rush is. And nobody can get enough of that.
You got another personality waiting in the wings?
I don't know. I hope somebody comes along, but this is and this is good for Rush. It's good for us. It's just terrible if you're a Republican congressman or somebody that cares about the Republican Party. But I told somebody, look, we're all having a party, and Rush is in, but you know what I mean? And when we leave, they're going to have to clean up the house.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Coming up, it seems like the death of all newspapers is greatly exaggerated.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Week after week, the news industry covers the grim developments in the news industry. Chief among them, layoffs, cutbacks, firings, and the closings of newspapers around the country. Just this week, both the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and the San Francisco Chronicle struggled to survive. But how much do people outside of the media really care about the death of newspapers? A recent poll by the Pew Research Center says, not so much. Fewer than a quarter of those under 40 years old say they would really miss the local newspaper they read most often if it were to fold. And only a third of those between 40 and 64 would. The only group that responded in a majority that they would miss their newspaper a lot was the 65 and over crowd. But forget about missing the paper. What about all those unreported stories? What about the toll on the community? Andrew Kohut is the president of the Pew Research Center. He says, in fact, most of the people they polled didn't seem too concerned about living in a town with no newspapers.
What we found was only 43% of the people that we questioned thought that civic life in their local community would be hurt a lot if local newspapers closed. And only 33% said they would miss newspapers a lot if those papers were no longer there.
Young people especially seem not all that put out about the death of an industry.
Well, yeah. I mean, you have to be over 65 years of age to say that the closure of a newspaper would hurt the civic life of the community a lot. It's the oldsters who have this affection for newspapers and also feel they play an important role in American society.
One final thing. When your interviewers were asking these questions, were they making it clear to the respondents that with the death of newspapers comes the death of the online product as well?
No, they weren't making that point, and it's probably something worth considering. But, a lot of the reason why people are thinking that their local community news wouldn't be affected is because they believe that television produces a lot of the crucial reporting in their local communities. And that's where they're going for their local news, by a goodly margin over newspapers.
Well, that's not long for this world either. Andy, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Bob.
Andrew Kohut is president of the Pew Research Center.
As you read about all those papers struggling to beat the Reaper, it might surprise you to learn that not every paper is recoiling from the sharp edge of his scythe. I do love grisly metaphors. In our coverage, we've overlooked the newspapers that cater to growing immigrant populations in major cities around the country. El Diario La Prensa, based here in New York City, is the nation's oldest and one of its largest Spanish-language newspapers. Executive editor Alberto Vorvolius explains that El Diario is actually thriving.
El Diario has been the fastest growing newspaper in America out of the last 3 years. Ad sales have suffered due to the recession, but we're doing better than any other newspaper I know.
So what makes you so special?
Well, I think we're better than all other newspapers, of course. But in addition to that, El Diario knows its readership, and we have a readership that, on the one hand, involves Latinos in the New York, New Jersey area, recent immigrants, as well as people who have been here for several generations. And also our audience is very much a working class, lower middle class audience. We feel that the information we provide to them is essential information that really is most effectively given through a newspaper form rather than through other media.
And why is that?
Many of our readers don't have desk jobs, which means they don't spend all day in front of a monitor checking up on websites to see what the latest news is. And therefore, they take the paper into the office, share it with the people they work with, take it home at night, and share it with their families.
New York has the second largest Hispanic population in the country?
That's correct.
And your audience is pretty diverse.
It's very diverse. In fact, New York has the most diverse Hispanic population I know of. In terms of our readership, we have important number of readers from every country in Latin America. So we very much know that our readers live, like so many of us, with a foot in two different worlds.
And you don't have the usual international, national, and local desks at the paper. You seem to cover international stories like local stories.
Absolutely. A number of different neighborhoods in New York that are tied to different communities in Latin America. For example, doing some local reporting, we came across a story involving the problems facing the fast-growing Mexican community in Staten Island. And so we did coverage about some harassment issues, possible anti-Hispanic crimes in Staten Island. The reporter figured out that he was interviewing hundreds of people who all came from the same village in Oaxaca. So we sent him to Oaxaca, to that village, and did a little profile connecting up to their families that live in Oaxaca to try to tell the story of why they left, why they send money home, what that money is used for. Often the money that's sent home from Staten Island is far more important to San Marcos than the federal money they receive from the government of Mexico.
So do you think your newspaper offers any lessons to the struggling mainstream papers in the country?
Yes, absolutely. I think it offers very interesting lessons. I hope they don't pay attention, but I think first is that most English language newspapers have tried to reach out to a very broad suburban middle class audience. And as a result of that, working class Americans have been left out of the coverage equation.
Let me just interrupt and say we know why they do that, because middle class people buy the products that are advertised in the papers.
Indeed, it's a more moneyed audience.
Are you giving up that advertising when you focus on the working class?
Well, you gain a different sort of advertising. What you need to do is to be able to connect to an audience. Clearly, the audience that English language newspapers have connected to seem to be deserting them for far more effective and inexpensive means of getting their information. So that's one. Second, we find that we cover issues and neighborhoods where there is really no presence from the English language press. There are large pockets of our society that are simply not covered, and they feel it. They know it. You can see the absence, their absence from the pages if you look at the major newspapers.
A lot of El Diario's success has to do with the fact that it's on paper. The very thing that we all say is passing into the mists of history. Now, you have a pretty robust web presence. Do you ever wonder if as the immigrant population changes, becomes more moneyed, sits in front of a computer screen more, that you might lose or that perhaps you ought to charge for that content?
Well, for us, it's not a matter of losing readers to the internet. It's being able to extend to a whole wider generation of readers, because we understand that our younger readers prefer to get their news online, and we want to be the place where they get their news.
If your younger readers are getting the information online for free, haven't you simply just postponed the crisis?
Well, no. One of the things that I think is a bit of a misconception is that people think of both immigration and demographic change as if they were waves. The wave comes in and then there's nothing left and you wait for the next wave. But in fact, we have a constantly replenishing pool of readership for our paper edition. In addition to that, we want to reach out to the second and third generation readers who like what we do, the way we cover news, which is different from any other publication. So it's not like the pool is emptying out.
You know, newspapers that cater to immigrants and to non-English speakers, they hardly ever figure into these discussions about the death of the newspaper. Do you ever yell at your radio or television when somebody says newspapers are dead?
Yes, absolutely. I yell all the time. If you look at every major American city, what you have is thriving ethnic media, whether it's newspapers or radio and sometimes television. And it's media that completely exists under the radar. And it's ironic that one of the barriers, the limitations to imagination in terms of newspapers, that if it doesn't happen in English to them, it seems like it doesn't exist. Which is sad, because I think, you know, ethnic media is doing a lot of very interesting things.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alberto Varvolius is the executive editor of El Diario La Prensa.
WikiLeaks is an online clearinghouse for secrets. Launched in December 2006, the website publishes leaked documents from anonymous whistleblowers across the globe. The site tends to grab headlines for its most salacious leaks. For example, it posted the contents of Sarah Palin's hacked email account during the presidential campaign. And this week, it posted the personal information of 51,000 supporters of ex-Senator Norm Coleman, hacked from his campaign's website. The site's investigations editor, Julian Assange, says that the real work of the site mostly goes unnoticed. For instance, it recently uncovered documents that detailed Kenyan political assassinations. But we wondered about the broader implications of a site that publishes sensitive information with next to no editorial discretion. I asked Julian if, hypothetically, he would publish information sent to his website that could lead to the deaths of innocents, such as, for instance, how to release anthrax into a town's water supply.
Yes, even if there's a possibility that it would lead to loss of life. It's hard to imagine a circumstance where we would get a document and us not publishing it would be helpful. If they were ill-motivated, then they could send that in private to terrorist groups, to neo-Nazi organizations, and those organizations could then develop their plans out of the sunlight. And that's the greatest harm.
In arranging this interview, you declined to provide your telephone number to our producers, or your whereabouts for that matter.
We are a bit cagey about some of our communications. The reason is that we deal with intelligence sources every day. If too much is known about the journalists that are working with us, their telephone can be tapped and monitored, and sources that are communicating with them can be monitored. The results of a slip-up on our behalf could be fatal to some of the people that we work with. So we're very cautious to make sure that people can't get at our sources by obtaining our telecommunications records.
Not long ago, you were in an interesting situation. You inadvertently, your organization, inadvertently sent to all solicitees the entire list of the people you were soliciting. You failed to put it in the BCC field. And as a consequence, everybody who got the email asking for money knew who everybody else was who had been solicited. Someone sends the list back to you and challenges you, I guess, in effect, to post on WikiLeaks your own inadvertent leak. And you did so. But I dare say, Julian, that if someone had gotten a hold of all of your sources and sent it to WikiLeaks, you would not post it for fear of the imprisonment or murder of some of your confidential sources.
We make sure that we destroy any information about our sources as soon as we can. But supposing some of those journalists, their telephone records were dumped, and yes, it's a black and white case of someone definitely being killed, then we will find a way to sit on the information until it's no longer of such a harmful consequence. But fortunately, we have never come to the point where we've had to really consider, is someone very likely to be harmed by what we're releasing?
Clearly, there are circumstances when you do draw the line at the release of certain material. The one that we talked about was when your own sources are at risk of arrest or physical violence. Doesn't that make you want to pull back and look at the general process you consider so inviolable at the moment?
There is an argument for notification of people before we release material. And we have done that where we think there is a potential for personal harm that is reasonable, not fantasy. I don't think there is an argument for other forms of censorship.
Can I just question your use of the word censorship? Because that is something that governments impose on third parties. When the third parties themselves impose it, you could call it self-censorship, or you could just call it judgment.
WikiLeaks is not a normal news organization. We are a public service to whistleblowers who are trying to get their messages out. Our judgment would be a form of censorship of those whistleblowers.
Investigative reporters and news organizations have feasted on the documents provided by whistleblowers since time immemorial. But when information is particularly sensitive, the news organizations typically will give the government an opportunity to persuade the news organization that for whatever reason, it is extremely dangerous to release some or all of what has been leaked. Why is that such a bad idea?
Well, CBS followed that practice for 8 months, concealing Abu Ghraib until it was scooped by The New Yorker. So that kind of practice is not something that journalism should be proud of whatsoever. You have to think where your loyalties are. And for a news organization, that primary loyalty should be to its readers, or it should be to its sources. Our primary loyalty is to our sources, secondary loyalty to our readers. To me, it's kind of amazing. I mean, you either believe in a free press or you don't. And if you do, then people should act like it. And we act like it because we do.
Well, Julian, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Julian Assange is the investigations editor for WikiLeaks.
And now we want to offer a couple of corrections. The first is actually a lapse of journalistic judgment concerning references we made to the now defunct public radio show The Infinite Mind. The program's host, Dr. Fred Goodwin, was found to have collected more than $1 million in fees from drug companies. We called him to fact-check a dispute between him and executive producer Bill Lichtenstein, who said he had no knowledge of the money. Goodwin told us that Lichtenstein was aware that he'd received some money, just not how much, and he gave us the name of a producer to corroborate. When we reached her, she said that the show was aware of Goodwin's conflicts of interests. We reported that. We also reported that Lichtenstein denied it. What we did not do was call him. That was a mistake. It wasn't fair and it didn't serve our listeners, so this week we did. Lichtenstein told us that he also spoke to that anonymous source, who said that she had no first-hand evidence that he knew of any fees. He emphasized that, in fact, he was not aware of Goodwin's financial ties to drug companies and that The Infinite Mind had always adhered to standard journalism practice in vetting guests and disclosing conflicts of interest.
And now correction number two concerns an interview we did with Robert Rosenthal, director of the Chauncey Bailey Project, an ad hoc group of journalists working to finish reporting the stories Bailey was working on when he was murdered in Oakland. In that interview, we suggested that the project had broken the story of a link between the lead detective on the Bailey case and Bailey's alleged assassins. Not so, writes Ken Connor, Metro editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. Quote, let me first say that we have nothing but the highest regard for the work the many talented journalists on the Bailey Project have done, and Rosie, he refers to Rosenthal, is one of the finest journalists I have ever known. But to clarify, the Bailey Project did not break the story about the link between the lead detective on the Bailey slaying and the bakery members allegedly involved. The San Francisco Chronicle broke that page one story months before the project. Keep those corrections coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And for our part, we'll keep screwing up to give you something to write about.
Coming up, how to fix what's wrong with the net without ruining what makes it so right.
This is On the Media from NPR.
On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This year, the internet turned 40. And that's an age when you start to feel a little vulnerable, especially if you've worked too hard, played too hard, and swallowed too many foreign substances without reading the warning labels. You could pick up a virus, a parasite, or worms. Conficker is all three. It can hop from computer to computer on its own power. It can attach itself to an innocent document. It can guess passwords and slip in through the back door. Last year, it infected roughly 12 million computers. Eventually, security teams defanged it. Then, just a few weeks ago, a new, more virulent strain appeared. The last time Conficker invaded U.S. computers, it mostly lay dormant. It didn't do anything. But there's no telling what it could do, because Conficker is a multi-stage program. First stage, infect. Second stage, act. Imagine 12 million remotely controlled computers, an enormous botnet.
A botnet is essentially taking the open internet and turning it into a supercomputer.
John Markoff covers technology for the New York Times.
In theory, at some point, they will send the programming instructions to all the computers that have been turned into zombies, that have been taken over by Conficker, and they can do whatever they want. And so what might that be? They could cause them to distribute more malware. They could cause them to send spam. They could cause them to basically send fire hoses of data at different companies or networks on the internet and shut them down. And no one knows what's planned.
The internet's creators didn't fret over apocalyptic infections. In its first 19 years, it was the playground of trusting techies and innocent geeks. Then it became available for use on college campuses. And, well, you know what happens in college.
In November of 1988, a Cornell University graduate student whose name was Robert Tappan Morris launched this program into the internet, which was then composed of about 60,000 computers. And he meant to simply have a program that would travel around the then brand new network and basically do nothing.
Robert Tappan Morris, RTM, just wanted to leave his mark, a little internet graffiti. But anticipating the network's computers would rebuff his little program, he tweaked it so that it would send itself over and over again. The adolescent internet was completely overwhelmed.
Think about the Sorcerer's Apprentices, all those broomsticks running around. And it turned out to be a catastrophic programming mistake, and he brought the network to its knees.
It was the first worm. The thing is, 20 years later, the internet is still susceptible to that kind of worm. Only now, the importance of the net has grown, and along with it, so has the sophistication of the attacks and the sense of impending doom, which the Air Force in this ad says it's ready to confront.
nuclear power is regulated through the use of computers. Your water system is regulated through computer systems. Because we operate so much in cyberspace, that is the new battlefield.
What we've seen in the course of the last 12 months is the United States government admitting publicly that both China and Russia have hacked their way into secret computer systems in the Pentagon, including the Secretary of Defense's own computer system.
Richard Clark, now author and security consultant, served as special advisor to President Bush on cybersecurity.
I think it's very plausible that a group could, for whatever motivation, achieve destruction in the real world by things that they do on the Internet. The United States government has proved to its own satisfaction that you can attack the electric power grid through cyberspace.
Like the plot of the Bruce Willis film, Live Free or Die Hard.
Transportation systems crashing and they just hit the entire financial sector, everything, all of it.
Power outage keeps spreading, about half the East Coast has already gone down.
Hey, wasn't that about a pathologically frustrated former cybersecurity official who proves our vulnerability by almost destroying the country?
Yeah, unfortunately, the New York Times review of Live Free or Die Hard suggested it was modeled after me, which I didn't consider very flattering.
So then what's the solution? Is it just better software, essentially fixing the devices we use to connect to the net, or do we need a new internet?
I think we need parallel internets for a limited number of very sensitive functions. What I'm talking about is probably migrating less than 1% of internet traffic off the internet.
You know, I'm just wondering, even if the Pentagon were to develop its own very secure net, any time it hooked up to the regular net, it would become vulnerable, would it not?
Well, that's exactly what happened 2 months ago. The people working in the Pentagon on the real unclassified internet were downloading things and putting them on their thumb drives and then moving their thumb drives over to classified computers. Well, guess what? The Russians figured that out. And the Russians came up with a virus that looked for Pentagon internet addresses and then looked for computers that had thumb drives on them and downloaded a virus onto those thumb drives. And the virus then walked across the room and got into the top secret network of the Pentagon.
So the hope of a separate network is really a false hope, right?
No, I think if you are going to have a separate network, you have to have some real discipline on it. And what the Pentagon did after the fact was went around with cement and actually cemented up the USB connections on their computers so that people couldn't use thumb drives.
Oh, give me a break. Cement? This is why many computer scientists say it's time to consider a wholesale redesign of the way data flows on the net.
The infrastructure that makes up the core of the internet, the switches, the routers, they really haven't changed since the dawn of the internet 40 years ago.
Stanford engineer Nick McEwen is part of the Clean Slate program, one of several efforts around the world to create a net that is capable of evolving.
It hasn't stayed still because it was perfect. It's really stayed still because as soon as there are billions of users using the internet, it becomes almost impractical to change.
Take those aging routers. They're kind of like the post offices that sort and deliver our data online. Routers have to be adjusted or replaced by hand. That's why it took more than a dozen years to fix a mounting problem. Not enough IP addresses, the unique tags composed of digital bits that every computer online is supposed to have.
Today it uses 32 bits. The idea is to use 128 bits. And so when you move from 32 to 128, there are so many possible addresses that there is no way we're going to run out. So, very simple idea. Took 15 years to introduce. Why was that? It was because the network itself, how did the switches and routers know to look at the 128 bits instead of 32? It's baked into all of the boxes.
All the boxes in the whole world. How much easier it would be, say the folks at Clean Slate, if we could just send instructions to the routers when the need arose.
For us, it was a collective rallying cry, a wake-up call to ourselves to say, you know, we really should be thinking a little bit more outside the box. Let's ask the question, What would we do if we had the opportunity to start over from scratch? How would we design the internet?
The new network architecture isn't going to solve our problems.
Researcher Stefan Savage teaches computer science at the University of California, San Diego. He says he likes to use an unfair analogy.
The question I like to ask people is, what are you going to do to the highway system to reduce crime? And when you put it that way, it sounds absolutely ridiculous. Because while criminals do use the highway, no rational person is suggesting that if only we could change the transportation architecture, that crime would go away. And yet, in a certain sense, that's what people who propose that a new internet architecture is going to solve our security problems are heard to be saying.
Most of the experts I spoke to said we have far less to fear from cyber terrorists than we do from online vandalism and crime, a flood of spam, a website crash, a clever ripoff. But Savage says we're fighting that battle exactly wrong. There are way more computers than computer criminals, and yet...
We tend to focus on protecting the PCs, spending about $100 billion a year on IT security. We have chosen the broadest and most expensive front to take on this fight. And I'm suggesting that, in fact, there are bottlenecks on the financial side of cybercrime that are far more vulnerable.
Savage says more cops should be following the money, and he doesn't think we should mess with the structure of our wide-open, free-and-easy, online, nobody-knows-you're-a-dog internet, because that's what's led to everything we now enjoy. YouTube, Google, the World Wide Web itself. They happened because people willingly took candy from strangers and risked having their computers turned into zombies or bricks.
The fact that we have these rich experiences on the internet where you can have Flash come up and you can have messages from all of your different friends on Facebook and so forth is a testament to that freedom. And I just can't contemplate, I mean, you'd be literally inventing everything from scratch. And I'm not sure if you could replicate a significant fraction of the experience that we have today. That one I don't see happening.
I don't believe that a practical alternative to the internet is conceivable.
Clay Shirky teaches new media at New York University and is author of Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations.
In part because of the installed base, but also in part because I don't think anyone would allow the engineers to do their work in peace.
Any improvements would have to pass muster with copyright holders, law enforcement, political interests. The pressure would crush any wholesale redesign of the net. But Shirky does think that adjustments are needed to cope with the fundamental problem of life online, anonymity. The internet's greatest virtue is also its greatest vice. Hippie geeks built the internet on trust. We need to address the reality that often nowadays, trust is not an option. The old neighborhood just ain't what it used to be.
How do two people who want to do business with each other come to trust each other?
The answer, says Shirky, actually comes from a professor of political science named Robert Axelrod.
And Axelrod's answer was only the shadow of the future, right? I won't rook you in a transaction today because you and I might do business again tomorrow. And so successful regimes create the shadow of the future, and then they can actually set up cooperating networks even inside incredibly hostile environments. We start having digital signatures in one way or another that says essentially, I trust you directly because we've done some business together, or I trust you because people I know trust you, or I don't trust you, no one I know trusts you, and then I'm either going to not do business with you or I'll do business with you at arm's length.
So how would we know when it's safe to take candy from a stranger? What would a good housekeeping seal of approval look like online?
It could look like a dashboard on your machine.
Jonathan Zittrain is co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society and author of The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It.
Before you run some new code, the dashboard would have a needle that simply indicates whether experts or not tend to run the code. And then I can piggyback on the decisions of the nerds about what they run and what they don't.
Right now, Zittrain sees a worrisome trend. People handing over responsibility for their online security to outside vendors with cool new toys. It's happening now. Take the iPhone. It's a lot like a computer, except outsiders can't write programs for it unless they submit them to Apple first. Only Apple decides if it can go on the phone. The upside? A more secure device.
The downside is it sets up a new gatekeeper that's going to have its own motives and incentives that are not always the same as the consumers it's supposed to serve.
Example, somebody submitted an iPhone application to Apple called Freedom Time. Basically, it was a countdown clock for the Bush administration, and it had the tagline, "Till the end of an error." The author couldn't understand why it was rejected.
Steve Jobs wrote him back when he complained and said, "This is an application that will offend roughly half of our users. What's the point?" And my strong belief is that so much of the code we now think of as central and crucial and cool and revolutionary is code for which, when most rational people first see it, their reaction is, "What's the point?" You could say that about something like Twitter. Somebody says, "Now people can update their status with 140 characters or fewer." And the obvious reaction to that is, "What's the point?" Or with blogs or with Wikipedia, "Now at last, everybody can edit a page simultaneously. I'm sure it'll produce a reliable encyclopedia." You know, the right answer to that is, "You guys are on drugs." And it's only when somebody can just try it out and doesn't have to persuade anyone else that this is something for which there's a point that you get this kind of innovation taking place.
Say we want to stay in charge of our own security and get in on that innovation. How? Zittrain has an idea involving what he calls red and green zones on our computer's hard drive. A safe zone for our most important documents, bank records, health records, the novel we're writing, that would be blocked off from internet invaders. And then another zone where we play at our own risk. One thing he's sure of, we have to figure this out and offer ways to work and play online with confidence. Because if we don't...
Most people will naturally migrate away from the personal computer as we know it and into architectures that are much more like gated communities with the security outsourced to a vendor. And that would be an unfortunate state of affairs. You'd end up with just the nerds back in their own playpen, happily doing cool things, but not able to share it with the rest of us.
So once there was this thing that was too good to be true, and then the whole world got in on it, and then it wasn't true. It's a sticky wicket, adapting the erstwhile nerd's playground to the realities of a nasty world. People used to call the internet the information superhighway. But to me, it's more like a beating heart, pumping oxygen to every nook and cranny. Protect it, replace the valves, and close up the leaky pipes. But block its arteries and it will die. And with it, not just future Wikipedias and Skypes, but all that may come from unbounded interconnection, ad hoc communities, colliding imaginations, the terrible and glorious potential of minds unfettered by time and distance. All of that lives and dies by the net. More about some of the ideas you just heard, go to onthemedia.org, where you'll find practically unedited interviews with Jonathan Zittrain, John Markoff, Clay Shirky, and Richard Clark.
Next week, in the second installment of our three-part series on the Internet, we look at the intersection of privacy, reputation, and the law. What legal recourse do you have if someone publishes mean-spirited, salacious, and even defamatory material about you online? Michael Furtick is CEO of a company called Reputation Defender.
Unlike in the law, unlike in a courtroom, when someone reads something about you on the web, they do not have to believe it beyond a reasonable doubt. They just have to believe it enough not to take a risk on you. That is a murderously low threshold.
Tune in next week for our piece about personal privacy and the internet. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with help from Kara Gianfrido, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.